Oh, it ain't that simple, mate.
Hello and welcome to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast, where we talk about missions and poverty and just about everything related to those subjects. I am Fraser Scott here with Kevin Honore. Hey, Kev, how you doing?
Yeah, doing well, Fraser. How you doing?
Yeah, not too
bad. You got over that husky voice yet?
No, it still sounds very deep and masculine in my ears, at least.
Oh, very cool.
I'm sure our listeners will agree. We are in season three of the podcast, and we are talking about the six different types of partnerships that Bright Hope World has. We've talked about microloans, microenterprise, and education and training, and orphans and vulnerable children, and a bunch of others. And we've got two more to go in the series. And today we are talking about evangelism and church planting partnerships. And this is fascinating because what we see, and we really approach this subject as learners, it'd be fair to say, because the church is growing really quickly in the places that we work, and perhaps less quickly, perhaps even shrinking in the places where we are and where our donors are. And so we've got to orient ourselves with some humility and say, boy, we've got some things to learn here. And I suppose it's worth a bit of a disclaimer at the beginning, because we're going to talk about the church. We're going to contrast as we go, no doubt, knowing what Kevin and I like. We're going to contrast the church in the West versus the church in the developing world. And so it's important that we say really clearly that we're both in fantastic churches. We're both connected with fantastic churches in New Zealand and Australia and the US, the UK, Canada. And we see wonderful things happening. And so you'll need to treat some of our observations perhaps as generalizations. We're focusing on the areas where we can grow and develop. But no way should that be read as demeaning or deprecating the wonderful things that are happening in the church in the West, and the wonderful people that are serving to their fullest extent and bringing people to the Lord and growing people in discipleship. So please do take that as read. If you do have thoughts and dare I say it, complaints, we always love to get those at podcast@brighthopeworld.com. If we've overstated anything, we might even apologise. You just never know. So I think it is important that we say that. We don't want to be seen as too negative or too critical. But before we get into it, Kev, let's set a bit of a scene here. Because the fact is that Christianity is growing fastest in some of the places that we work, in Africa and in Asia. And the situation has changed a lot. In the year 2000, 814 million Christians lived in Europe and North America, whereas 660 million Christians called Africa and Asia home.
So that's just 23 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, it's 838 million live in the global north. So not that many more. But 1.1 billion Christians live in Africa and Asia.
So it's doubled.
It's doubled.
Yeah.
And the fact is that, broadly speaking, and even accounting for population growth, the church is shrinking in Western countries, in most Western countries, but appears to be booming and expanding and spreading out and doing pretty impressive things elsewhere. So, Kev, we're involved in evangelism and church planting in a lot of places. Why is the church growing in the places where we work? What are they doing?
Well, yeah, there's some interesting trends to observe. I think one thing you do have to say is that, and it's a bit of a disclaimer as well, is that just because the church is growing in these places doesn't mean to say it doesn't have problems.
It does have some problems.
It has some problems. So, referring back to Fraser's comments, it's not that simple just to compare or contrast here, you know, in the West and there, and say it's all rosy there and it's all bad here, because there's good and bad stuff happening in both areas. And now, probably good and bad is probably not the right words to do. There's positives and negatives in both. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to come across as saying, well, everything's great out there and it's all bad here.
No, because it's just not true.
It's not.
It's a romantic view that we can sometimes slip into. It's not the case.
Yeah, no, and so bear that in mind as we talk about about this. One of the things that's interesting is that, you know, where it is growing in Asia and Africa particularly, the growth is faster, slightly faster than the population growth. So that's a really interesting trend. So they are claiming new territory, if you like, there, which is a healthy thing. It's not just biological growth. It's really what we're saying. So what's happening out there? I think one of the things that you notice is that the gospel out there just radically transforms lives. And that's probably because it's, you know, people are coming from radically or kind of extreme other situations, circumstances into faith. And so the life change is very obvious. It's what, you know, Paul talks about in 1 Thessalonians, the end of chapter 1, where he says, you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God.
Right, yeah. All Paul's conversion itself goes from being a persecutor
to a 180 degree turnaround. And that's, in a sense, more starkly obvious when people come from, say, paganism to Christianity. But it's really interesting to see as well that, you know, like where a lot of our partners are working, quite a bit of their work, even say in a lot of Muslim countries, is amongst nominal Christian people.
Yeah.
And so, but even there, there's a radical turning around of values, I guess.
So is part of the what you're describing there, the fact that in these places, people are aware that they have a belief system. It's more overt. You know, I heard a guy say at a conference some years ago that there are no atheists in Africa. That everyone has a belief. I mean, everyone does have a belief system.
Yeah, well, even in New Zealand,
they own it. Yeah, a lot of people in New Zealand say, "No, I'm not religious." My view is always, "Oh, yes, you are." But it is more overt there, and so the move is more evident.
Yeah, and I think it's becoming a little more like that even here now too, where the conversion experience or the transformation, there's a much greater battle of worldview and values observable, and where that happens, you seem to get a different quality of transformation occurring, and so I think we're starting to see that here in the West as well, where people are more distant from Christian faith than maybe they were 30, 40, 50 years ago. So when they become Christians, there's a more radical turnaround. The same thing's happening out there in most of these places.
So Christianity does not inform the mainstream culture.
That
when one becomes a believer,
it's a radical.
You stand out more.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, your values have to change radically because they were radically wrong before. For people who grew up in a nominal kind of Christian environment, they still had many of the same values as real believers, but they still didn't have a personal relationship with Christ.
I suppose one of the challenges in that as well, and we see this in I think Buddhist countries and Muslim countries as well, is you're battling syncretism.
Yep.
Where people become from Islam or from Buddhism, become a believer, but sort of hold on to some of the remnants and fuse together some of the beliefs from the old system to the new.
Yeah,
I guess that's
yeah.
also an issue here, isn't it? You know, people move from Western secular humanism and yet retain a lot of that as well. Everyone's battling that issue.
Yeah, totally. But the good news for poor people is really good news.
Mm.
The good news or the gospel for rich people, even in Jesus' day, was significantly bad news at the start of the story, of the narrative, because it threatened their lifestyle, their values, and they recognized that it threatened, you know, everything about their what they held as true and dear. And so there's a significant amount of bad news for the wealthy when you hear the good news. And a lot of people never get past hearing the bad news in the West. Out there, when you've got nothing, everything's good news, pretty much. especially when you start talking about grace and forgiveness and hope and all the things that are embedded in the good news. They have nothing to lose. So they say yes quite easily, quite quickly. Then the issue becomes discipling those people.
Yeah.
And that's where, as we observe church planting movements and disciple making movements that we're connected with, that whole discipling becomes a significant task for those that are leading the movement.
And you talked about the fact that, you know, the gospel really transforms lives. My observation in that is when people become believers, there are certain expectations which are just embraced, that, okay, I live differently now. Yeah. I don't live as I lived before.
Yeah.
I mean, almost to the point where there is a view, I'm going to be persecuted. I'm going to be poorer, perhaps, than I was. I'm not going to operate with the movers and shakers because this is a choice I've made. One wonders if that also stands in contrast here, where at least in the past, becoming a believer has been in no way an impediment towards, you know, living the American dream.
But
perhaps that's changing.
Yeah, I think it is changing here. I think this is definitely, and that's what you see out there, and I think what's starting to happen here, you get this clash of cultures, where you know, the gospel culture runs headlong into the local culture. And when that local culture is like witch doctors and stuff that's very in your face and obvious, then the battle of the culture occurs very obviously. For a long time here, it didn't, there wasn't that clash to the same degree. Now there is much more. So clear choices have to be made. We see this in a lot of the places where our partners are working, where people, you know, have to leave their ethnic or tribal or family culture or are excluded from it because they join the Jesus culture, the Kingdom of God culture. And so, we're starting to see that a bit more in the West as well, as people come to faith.
One of the factors, and this certainly doesn't feel like good news, but where I see the church thrive, there is an environment of persecution, and sometimes quite acute. It has a purifying effect. I mean, we know that scripturally. The nominal do tend to drop off once that raises. So is that a factor in why we see the church growing more quickly? Is they have that force, it strengthens them as it always has, and that perhaps that's, again, what we're not necessarily experiencing outside the majority world.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you need, if you go back into the scripture, especially the New Testament and a lot of Peter's writings, suffering produces something that nothing else can produce, a depth of character that nothing else produces in the Christian. So, yeah, that's our observation, you know, at the real life level as well, as we observe our partners out there. Suffering, persecution produces something that, and it's really funny, I noticed that the other day when we were in Pakistan. We were on a bus and we're talking to this two guys who are from way up in the north of Pakistan, on the China border with Pakistan, and they were a different ethnic group, and we were chatting away, and it was interesting just to listen. And then we got to the end of the journey, and there was Azam, our partner, standing outside the bus. And when I was talking to these people, I wasn't sure how much you say about faith and all that. And we jump off the bus, and I introduce this guy to Azam, and Azam says, "Oh, when I'm up there next time, I'll come and visit you," and got his number and all that. And I want to just tell you that, you know, about Jesus and blah, blah, blah. And he was like right into it, and it's like, why can't I do that and talk like that and say that? So there's a real vibrancy and courage and bravery that is produced by suffering that we in the West don't have to the same degree.
Well, there's some worldview differences, aren't there? I mean, one of the things, I can't remember if we've talked about this before, but about, you know, the guilt innocence culture that we live in versus the honor shame culture. And there's a fantastic book that talks about this. And, you know, the fact that, you know, that cultural difference, that we tend to process our morality internally, we enforce it internally, whereas in those places it's far more, you know, externalized and those things matter. Yeah. It creates a different kind of believer, does it not?
Yeah, it does, very much. Yeah, I'm just inspired when I with those guys, because they just seem so unimpeded by fear and saying the wrong thing or offending somebody or you know, all that sort of stuff.
It's like,
oh, if you offend somebody, then you deal with it. You know, it's like for us, it's like.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think as well, you know, another aspect that I've observed is, you know, we tend, again, it's worldview issue, we tend to see our life in silos. You've got the work silo and kids and, you know, and all these different areas. And church or our faith is another one of these that competes. And we talk about balance and all that sort of thing. Whereas the conversations I have with people in Africa and Asia and in the Middle East, I should say, it tends to be, right, my mission and my calling is at the center, and everything sort of bolts onto that and works around that it works synergistically with that. So it's not that I sacrifice my kids for my mission, but that the kids are sort of pulled in and become part of the whole deal,
yeah.
And
we take them with us.
Yeah, and I suppose what's connected with that as well is that, you know, in so many of these places, when people become believers, they become ministers right from day one. They adopt the ministry of reconciliation. They're like, right, I'm now, I'm you know, I've got a job to do. Whereas I guess, you know, dare I say it, that we perhaps have a more of a professionalism within the church. So I become a believer, but it's your job, Kev. You're trained, you're paid. You go do the ministry stuff. I'll keep my head down.
There is a bit of that. And where this is working, you know, in our networks, where the church is growing the fastest, where it's having the most impact, is where everybody from day one becomes a transmitter of the good news. And it's fascinating where perhaps the fastest growing one that we're involved with, you know, which is doubling less than every 2 years, you know, the people that are leading the groups that are forming, and there's hundreds of them forming every day, are only 1 week ahead of the people that they're leading.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so the whole the expectation is there that as immediately you become a believer, your network is your mission field. So you just start doing that, and it's just part of everyday life. You know, those people that were coming into your home next week, they will come into your home next week, but you will talk about Jesus before you wouldn't. And you'll find ways to influence them. And then put that on the back of a transformed life, when all of a sudden these people that were harsh and unforgiving all of a sudden start to become loving.
And they look different in
their lives. Becomes a very attractive thing. So they don't actually have to say very much. We have to say quite a bit. Much more. Our words are more important here because there's a bigger difference between a gap between what we say and what we do, and how we live. Over there, the transformation, and because people there live so close to each other, they notice the change instantly. It happens, you know. Just fascinating to see. Mm-hmm. And then I guess coming towards the end of this section, Fraser, but one of the things I've noticed as well, there's a huge emphasis where these church planting movements are going off on training and innovative use of technology.
Yeah.
So they're using, you know, different ways to just keep their leaders, their key people, upskilled and encouraged and strengthened. So, like in one place, we help them. Their strategy is to every week bring together all their key leaders once on a Tuesday, and so we've helped provide bicycles so they can all get there on the Tuesday. And again, when that began many years ago, that partnership, a lot of those people were just 1 week ahead, so they'd get their lesson and they'd go back and teach their people.
You don't have to be an expert.
Yeah, you don't have to. And I think in the West, there's something to learn from that for us. I think one of our problems is we tend to have this process where if we want somebody to become a missionary or a minister or whatever, we send them off to this place that is unrelated to life, and we sit them behind a desk and we fill them up with information. And it's like we almost kill the vibrancy and the passion. And then we say, well, now go out and...
And be vibrant and passionate.
Be vibrant and passionate. And
yeah.
Whereas, a lot of these guys, the vibrancy and passion is what's so powerful.
Yeah.
And the change and the mistakes. And so I think, what we're noticing is that a lot of these movements, people just go out. And then as they are out and they're doing what they do, they recognize what gifts they have. And some of them will be steered in one direction to become trainers on a broader scale. Others will do pastoral stuff. And so
it's,
the emphasis on educating here has almost overwhelmed the evangelism and the passion.
I heard someone describe it in these terms. They said, we sit around and we read cookbooks and we talk about cooking and we watch TV shows about cooking and we hear endless talks about cooking, but we never cook anything.
So
we just fill ourselves up with theoretical information that we often don't actually put into practice. But perhaps if we just, started breaking the odd egg here and there, that might be useful.
It's a little bit like trying to learn to swim by, correspondence course.
Yeah. I think as well, as we talk about innovation, and I see some phenomenal innovation from a couple of our partners. I think of the one you were referring to that's working with cell groups. We've got another partner in Thailand that is incredibly innovative with how they engage within a Buddhist culture.
Yeah.
And I recall, we did a conference in India a few years ago, and a Indian guy that was working in a tertiary institute there talked about, shared a quote with the bread of life coming to Africa. And he said, when the bread of life came to Africa, it was wrapped in plastic, meaning all of the European traditions and all that sort of thing. And he said, the Africans choked on the plastic until they realized they can pull the plastic off and enjoy the bread of life. And so what I see our partners doing is pulling that plastic off and I suppose de-Westernizing and, oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm going to use the word decolonizing the gospel. My goodness. And pulling that stuff off it so that people can access it in a culturally relevant way, that you don't need to stop being an Indonesian person or a Rwandan person in order to become a Christian. You don't need to dress like we do. And I see our partners doing some really clever stuff on that.
Yep. Yeah,
which then begs the question, I suppose, is, as a Christian culture here in New Zealand or the US, wherever, do we put barriers up in the same way to people from what is fundamentally a different culture, which is the non-Christian culture out there? I mean, these are the right questions to ask, I think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's, when you go down this track, and you start talking about how do you make it as relevant as possible or not, there's issues you've got to, you've got to deal with along there, but absolutely. So that's one of the things that I've noticed in that group I was referring to that's growing really quickly is that they stay within their culture. They still dress like Muslims. They may even go to the mosque, but they're praying to a different God. And in the past, when a person's become a believer, we've dragged them out and put a suit and tie on them, and see, that's what it means to be Christian. Well, I'm not sure that Jesus wore a suit and a tie, but it was very. They were still very much part of the culture. Obviously, along the way, some of them are going to be, if you like, ejected from the majority culture or family or tribe or whatever, and you have to deal with that. And that's largely where we're engaged with these church planting movements. It's not so much us doing the preaching or the evangelism. It's coming alongside these movements so that when the poverty starts to limit the growth of the movement, that there can be some resources available to help those people that come out, get new jobs, get loans to start new careers or get some different training or shift to another place.
Yeah.
Or whatever is required.
All right, we're going to take a little break there. We We have been talking for quite a while, as it turns out. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the understanding of the gospel and some of the practical ways that we see church planting and evangelism happening among our partners that inspire and excite and encourage us. We will be right back on It Ain't That Simple, Mate. It Ain't That Simple, Mate is brought to you by Lamai Coffee. Lamai Coffee is the finest quality organic Arabica coffee from the northern hills of Thailand. We at Bright Hope World import the green beans into New Zealand and we roast them to perfection, then sell them to discerning coffee drinkers. We're all volunteers on the team, so all the profits go back into great community projects in Thailand. And that is why we call it the world's best tasting act of kindness. You can order Lamai Coffee or find out more at lamai.co.nz.
Oh, it ain't that simple, mate.
Welcome back to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast, where today we are talking about evangelism and church planting partnerships, and we've been looking at some of the sort of different broad approaches and thinking around the areas where the church is growing most rapidly in the world and what we see. Kev, let's sort of boil it down to a little bit more of a specific focus.
Yep.
The way the gospel is communicated in other parts of the world, and again, particularly where the church is growing, how is that different? How does it look different to perhaps how we might approach the gospel or communicate the gospel?
Yeah, that's. It's hard to nail down all the different things because the gospel is a message, and in a sense, the message is not that different. I mean, the way you apply it is. Is obviously got to be culturally appropriate, and like I said before, I think there's a lot of. Well, actually, it's interesting. Having lived in Africa as well, one of the problems that you face in Africa is that a lot of churches love to shout at people and preach at people, but where the gospel is growing, it's much more of what I would call an alongside a kind of thing. Where now you get. You know, and you see it on TV, these big preachers in Africa, and they're running these big mass meetings and revivals and all this kind of stuff. But that's not where the real growth is happening. It's where the real growth is happening is where churches are getting the idea of going out into their communities and getting people engaging with the Word of God. Now, small groups, that's by far the most effective way we're seeing it, that not just conversions but disciples being produced.
So small groups, how many people are we talking?
Up to 10 or so.
Okay.
Small family groups. And nearly all of the growth areas we see, there's two or three things happening. One is people are being exposed to the Word. So what they'll do is they'll say, okay, here's seven questions, and they use this, call it the seven question
model. Yeah, I've come across that.
Here's seven questions. They print out a little card with seven questions on it, and then they can go to any verses in the Bible and just start reading them and answer those questions. You know, what does it say about Jesus? And so they start engaging, and nobody then has to be the teacher or the founder of all knowledge. Everybody's contributing, and so the Word becomes the teacher. The Spirit of God then takes that word and drives it into people's hearts. And so when people come to faith, they come on the basis of God having spoken to them through the Word of God. And it's not distorted by one guy's opinion or theological perspective, or maybe he's got the flashiest suit or the loudest microphone, right. You know, kind of thing. So you get this grassroots ground level thing happening. So that's one thing. The Word is a really important part. And as we mentioned earlier, the training of people, so the discipling of people becomes really important as part of that. And then immediately, if you like, commissioning these people to go out and tell somebody else about it. That becomes the the catalyst for growth.
So it's sort of a bottom-up rather than top-down.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's not about just a few professionals doing all the talking. This is everyone seeing themselves as having a role to play.
Yep.
I mean, how have they achieved that? Is it just that that's the expectation set from day one? This is what
no,
it looks
like? No,
it's
not. A lot of this is quite new. Because if you go back, you don't have to go back too far, where the gospel communication was largely dependent on people from outside coming in.
Right.
Quite well-resourced people from outside coming in. And that can only ever have limited impact, because those people can only ever meet so many people. And if they establish that as a model, then they send out people, you know, like them, then it becomes addition to the kingdom. Where when you start talking about just letting people go, it starts to become, you know, it's multiplication, it's not addition. And so it becomes a movement. It goes viral.
So, being very clear that you know, we still see huge value in certain places for sent missionaries.
Yeah.
That the, you know, part of the secret here, or part of the, you know, what's been most effective, is people sharing the gospel within their own culture.
Within their own cultures. Mm. Yeah, and I think, you know, if you're going to think about reaching every tribe and then reaching down through every generation, it's about local people or nearby people moving sideways and along their networks and into these areas. It's not going to be done entirely by somebody coming from outside, certainly not coming from out of the West. And so getting these grassroots movements going is a big key to this happening. Of course, there's issues associated with that as well, because, you know, you lose a bit of control, but then whose church is it anyway?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I guess the idea is you have this distributed model. You've got often little groups and lots of different places that are sort of, you know, loosely connected together, which I suppose has the additional benefit that when persecution kicks up, you've also got a far more protected group because
absolutely.
It's distributed.
Yeah, there's no one person or 10 people you can put in jail and stop the whole thing happening. And that's, remember, we talked to, I think I referred to it in this series, we talked to Bassam from Lebanon.
Mm.
He'd been discipling Syrian refugees, and they were only in Lebanon for a short period of time, and then they were gone all over the world. We said, do you feel unsafe? And he said, yeah, but it's too late. I mean, it's already got out.
The damage is done.
These people have already shot the gap, and they're just doing what they do where they are all over the world, all in several countries. So, that whole grassroots movement. And you know, it's really interesting that it's not that hard to start a ministry. It's very different to start a movement. You go about it completely different ways. And some really interesting observations we've made around some of that stuff as well. And a key one is this, it's got to become grassroots, local people amongst their own people.
So, you have been a pastor in a past life. And, you know, I imagine if you are a pastor listening to this, you sort of think, well, that's all well and good. But, it's not easy to mobilize, you know, people within the church. And I guess even for some of our partners, it's not that easy.
Hmm.
I mean, what do you do? How do you mobilize people like this to go out into their culture in a relational, informal, meaningful way and to see the church grow?
Well, it has to be on the basis of what you're modeling. Not, you know, you can't say, go and do this. It's like, hey, let's go together.
Let's go together. And
it is a fundamental mind shift required. You know, most pastors, and most of these movements aren't started by pastors, by the way.
Mm.
Most pastors see the congregation as being there to support them, where in these movements, the pastor sees that he's a resource for the church, for the congregation to go out into the world or into their community. And so it's an entirely topsy-turvy kind of way of thinking about it. And and radically threatening for many pastors to give it all away. And so, like I said in one of the earlier podcasts, many of the pastors in these places, or the leaders of these groups in these places where we're working, they're serving their people, and the, you know, that it's not the people serving them. It's a 180 degree turnaround. It's a different shape entirely.
We talked, I think it was in the previous podcast, about bivocationalism and about the fact that most of the partners that we're engaged with are doing ministry, and again, most of our team doing ministry, and you know, have a job, a role, a farm, a business alongside that. What part, if any, does that play in the church growing?
Oh, it's key to it almost. Most of the church planting movements we're involved with may have one or two full-timers, but the bulk of the people, and certainly all the activists, are just ordinary people living their lives, doing their jobs. We're working with two or three groups where they had the model in the past of full-time people leading everything, and we're trying to help them transition into being more bivocational. So we've helped set up in Africa a number of little businesses for the key people there, their families, to run those businesses to support the family while one of the drivers of that is that the money, the support from the West is diminishing. Really hard to for Western donors to give to full-time itinerant evangelists. It's a real, isn't, unless you've got kids with big eyes and flies crawling, it's hard to raise money, you know.
I mean, some people would say though that we're taking a hit in effectiveness there. We are muzzling the oxen, if you like, by sort of saying, well, hang on, wouldn't it be better if these people are achieving whatever they're achieving while they're working half-time and doing ministry half-time? Wouldn't they achieve twice as much if they didn't have to worry about, you know, raising support or, you know, operating their business, could focus on the ministry full-time?
Well, yes and no. They would have a bit more time available. But at the end of the day, when you move into, say, a new community or you're ministering to a community, especially if you're a minority group moving into a majority group, you need to be able to answer the question, or, you know, why am I here? Or when they say to you, why are you here? How are you supported? How do you live? You know, you need to be able to demonstrate that you're part of them. Otherwise, you'll never become part of them. You'll always be on the outside, sort of peering in, and then you never pick up the real nuances of that particular community and culture, and you often don't then engage with the right people in that. I mean, a number of stories of somebody going in from the outside full-time and they end up engaging with all the marginalized people in the community, which then becomes a barrier to the ordinary person in the community actually wanting to get involved. And so it's becoming part of the community is a hugely important part of this.
I suppose it carries some credibility. I mean, you know, I would imagine that for a number of our partners, if they're getting to know people and sharing the gospel, and those partners know, well, you're supported, you can just do what you do because you've got money flowing in from the West, I would imagine that creates a barrier that's hard to overcome.
And hard to explain. I think we're seeing that bivocationalism is really important. Of course, then they may be the ones that cross over from one place to another place, but then once it gets down into local people leading it, then that's not such a big deal, because these people are my brothers and friends and cousins and uncles and sisters, and they're the ones that are living out and talking this nonsense, this new religion, this new thing that's come along, and it's got much more credibility.
Yeah, exactly. Let's with the remainder of our time, I think it'd be great. You know, we've talked in sort of generalities about some of the work our partners are doing, and one has to understand that there are some confidences here that we've got to be careful about. But I think it'd be great to let's pick a couple of the partners where we see, really effective ministry, where we see successful evangelism, we see successful church planting. Let's explore a couple of these stories and tease out, you know, what they're doing and why it's working.
Yeah, well, I won't mention the country, but a large country in Asia where there's a significant movement going on. I mean, we get reports back from there like every couple of weeks of large numbers of people coming to faith, whole groups, whole villages coming to faith. And last year they baptized nearly 100,000 people. You know, it's like, it's, you can't even imagine the numbers, but none of that's centralized. What they've done there, and almost the key to the, two parts of the key to their success, is they very carefully record the numbers, so they're not exaggerating. They're not.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen these numbers. They are not one person is added to it that is not verified.
Yeah, and it's the guy who leads it is, I mean, he's a missionary from outside, and he's one of the few missionaries or few outsiders in it. But he was a mathematician before he became a missionary, and it's like he's got this, he's wired in a different way, but he's got this huge kind of framework that he uses to record all this information.
He's got a spreadsheet, and you're either a spreadsheet person or you're not, and I am, and his spreadsheet is very exciting for someone like me.
And I mean, he's got two people basically just adding data every day as the information comes in. So they're keeping track of it because they want to know what the trends are, where the holes are, where the strengths are, and who the key people are. And so they're really analysing it very carefully. And that's by far the largest one we've got. And most of the others that we're working with on a smaller scale, they would have something quite similar. They would know their people. They would know their network.
So this is a network of networks, if you like. There's thousands of groups. When something has started, what does it actually look like, practically speaking? What are these guys going out and doing? How are they adding to their number?
Yeah, well, they've got several tiers of leadership. At the top end, there's like about 14 of them, that's all. And they make all the key decisions around. And then they're discipling a number of people under them who are leading other people under them who are leading. And they're up to like over 20 generations.
Yeah.
And by generation, they mean like somebody has started a group that started a group that started a group 20-something
20
times.
Yeah.
So there's, it's multiplying out. But they keep track of all their key people. They're visiting around the people that are under them. So the 14, I know as I was there last time, he has about 50 people that he's visiting annually, like going around visiting them. And, of course, initially it started off in quite close geographical locations, but now it's spreading out. In fact, it's gone to several other countries. And each person has a group of people that they're responsible for.
So the leaders of those groups, they're going out, they're meeting people, they're saying, hey, come along to a group, or they're leading people to the Lord, and then they come along to a group.
I mean, yeah, and then so what happens is a person would go along to a group and become a believer. They would go back home, and then in that first week, they would invite their friends around and start talking to them about what's happened to them, what they've discovered. And that becomes another group. And so some of those people would become believers. They would go off and do the same thing again. And it just keeps multiplying because it's not about getting more and more people into our building. It's about sending out more and more people who have the capacity to know the gospel. Coming along behind that is something pretty innovative, is that they're if you like, training their key people with WhatsApp. And so they produce all these little short messages that become the key, and they can send them out really quickly.
Securely.
And securely. And so they And like we said earlier, that some of these people, you know, are less than a week in the faith, and they're already leading another group, so they don't know anything. So training them and equipping them and helping them to say the right thing to their people. They've developed this method of doing that.
So contrast that with
Western model, kind of more.
Well, no. But I mean, let's pick another one. Perhaps go to another part of the world and another movement. You sort of think, okay, there's some lessons there to learn.
Yeah, well, it's one group of guys that we work with that they're I guess you'd call them a parachurch group. But what they do, they've got key people who develop relationships with churches, and then they go into those churches and they. Once it takes a little bit of time sometimes to convince the pastor that this is a good idea, but they then train those churches to go out and do a similar thing to what we were talking about before. So they might go out and do some open air preaching if that's appropriate in that culture, and in much of Africa it still is. Or they may just get people together, similar to what I was saying before. Get their seven questions out, open up the Bible and start reading it, and people become Christians as that thing goes on. And we've got some, like one guy in southern Kenya, he travels into Uganda and down into Tanzania, and he's got hundreds of little groups going down there, little Bible reading groups, they call them. So that's pretty cool. The guys in Mozambique, they're doing some stuff there, which is... They've got these little what they call houses of prayer, prayer houses, because they don't want to use introduced terms because they're in a Muslim environment, and so they have washing ceremonies, not baptisms. They have different ways of explaining what's going on, little groups of families becoming believers, and then. Yeah, it's pretty exciting stuff.
So let's zoom out as we draw to a close. Let's zoom out, and I'm going to put you on the spot as
often not happens. Again, Fraser.
A lot of people are going to listen to this and go, "Well, I want this for my community, my country, my environment. You know, I want to see this sort of thing. I want to see 100,000 people baptized." What of all of the things that we've touched on? What is the one thing? Above all else, that we can do in the West to learn from what we're seeing in our partners in evangelism and church planting.
The one thing.
I mean, understanding that the right answer is prayer, right? I mean, we know that. Let's acknowledge that that's first
well, that's
and
right
foremost,
at the heart
what underpins
of all this
all.
Stuff. My goodness, out there, they know how to pray.
They know how to pray. But let's talk practicalities.
Pray. Yes, that's a good practicality, Fraser.
It is.
What show your Western slippers showing here.
Well, it is what could we do. I mean, it's pray and what?
Oh, dear. I think we've just got this. We've got to start being, I'll put it this way, being like them in terms of fearless and about talking about Jesus. Now... Yeah, and that's a real challenge for us, I think, because we feel like we've got so much to lose.
Yeah.
There's been in the past a big emphasis on friendship evangelism, but we've got to the point where we're scared of losing the friendship because of the evangelism. So just drop the evangelism if you think that's what you're doing. Just become friends, But no, I'm just joking. But we do have to become more fearless in talking about who Jesus is and our relationship with him and telling our story to people and how Jesus is at work. Of course, part of the problem is that many of us are just sitting in the pew and Jesus really isn't at work. We're in the context of being blessed by what other people are doing and all that kind of stuff. I think some churches could have a real look at how they're functioning. I mean, we've learned from some of these guys that it's about grassroots, not top down.
Yeah.
It's about everyday believers, not professionals. And how do you deal with that? How do you change that? How do you empower your people and send them out? It's about being relational rather than structural. And that's...
Yeah, I mean, you can't be a consumer at church
and do this situation. Stuff. No, absolutely it's not. It's about the group, not the individual. And that's a challenge for us Westerners.
Yep.
Because if you're getting truly engaged in this stuff, it's going to be very inconvenient for your structured lifestyle and nuclear family. I mean...
Well, I suppose the ultimate question is, you know, there's no reason in my mind that we couldn't see the same things that are being seen. The question is, are we prepared to sacrifice as our partners sacrifice? And it's very easy to think, oh, well, it's easy enough for them to share the gospel over there because it's different. But in some respects, the price they pay is far higher than anything we're likely to pay. I mean, we're fairly unlikely to pay with our lives for a start.
Yep. And that's why fearless is almost the key word, the key word here. It takes bravery, it takes courage. Read the New Testament.
That's a good start. Pray, read the New Testament, and be fearless. There you go. That's the formula. Hey, we're going to have to draw it to a close there. This is a big subject, and we could talk at length. But again, if anything we've said, discussed, has bothered you or inspired you or challenged you, do drop us a line, podcast@brighthopeworld.com or facebook.com/brighthopeworld. We'd love to hear from you. But for now, we will sign off. We have one more in our series where we're going to talk about agriculture and community development, which is a huge subject. But for now, we'll finish. Final thought, Kev?
Yeah, I'd go something like this, Fraser. You know, banging more people into a bigger and bigger building is not going to produce disciples. All it's going to do is create transfer growth, and it might look good on the statistics and the metrics and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's about producing fearless disciples who are out there just living and talking Jesus. So come up with a way to do that, is what I would say.
There you go. The mantle has been laid down there. The gauntlet has been thrown. Hey, thanks, folks, for joining us here on It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast. We look forward to joining you again very soon.